This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 368, was produced on March 23, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Nomura's Charlie McElligott returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the formative banking crisis, monetary policy, including yesterday's 25 basis point hike into the formative banking crisis, how to trade the Fed boxing itself into a corner, zero day to expiration options, abysmal performance of commodity trend funds in 2023, and much more. Macro Voices will be released a day early next week on Wednesday, March 29th, to accommodate travel schedules. So be sure to tune in next Wednesday afternoon instead of Thursday.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, March 23rd, 2023. The S&P 500 was up 1.1%, closing at 3970. What is noteworthy was the sharp reversal off the highs in the hours post the FOMC. Also worth mentioning is the relative strength of the NASDAQ continuing, which was up 2.7% week over week. We'll have the charts on this in the post game. The US dollar index down 2.1%, closing at 102.53, with a key breakdown on Powell's comments. The May WTI crude oil contract up 4.7%, closing at $70.90. We will look at that chart, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data in the post-game segment. Gold was up 2.5%, closing at 1979, the key 2000 round number resistance just overhead. Copper up 5.5%, closing at $4.05, rebounding sharply after last week's breakdown. Uranium up 0.3%, closing at $50.20. And the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 2 basis points, closing at 343 basis points, yield remaining on the low end of the range of the year. It will be a slow week for economic data releases. Key news to watch will be Friday. We have an array of global flash PMI numbers being released, as well next week on Tuesday, the U.S. consumer confidence numbers. This week's feature interview guest is Nomura's Charlie McElligott. Eric, why did we invite Charlie back on as a guest this week?
Well, Charlie has been a listener favorite, and I think he's a perfect guy to assess the banking crisis and how Fed policy is going to affect it. So we wanted to get him back on for that topic in specific, and generally it's been a long time and we're overdue for a Charlie fix.
Well, Eric's interview with Charlie McElligott is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Charlie McElligott, Nomura's cross-asset macro strategist. Charlie, what a perfect week to get you back on the show, because your team is really good at looking at market internals and the flows and so forth. Here's my question. If Bear Stearns just happened, and I contend it did, it's called SVB, and you're not sure if Lehman is about to happen next, how do you tell? Because the Fed and other government officials have a strong incentive to lie in order to shore up confidence. What can we look at in the market to tell whether this banking crisis is a flash in the pan that's already over, or if it's something that's just getting started?
Appreciate being here. Great to speak with you again. Look, this is one of those rare opportunities where I get to kind of step back from very tactical flows and look at some actually larger, you know, structural, strategic stories. And, you know, that is exactly what's happened over these past few weeks with regards to, you know, both the U.S. regional bank dynamic as well as the, you know, the EU bank story with CIVB and Signature and SI and Credit Suisse. You know, all of those fails are idiosyncratic symptoms of this larger bank profitability crisis becoming a solvency crisis. And, you know, as it relates to your question, these are long-term structural dynamics for banks whose kind of profitability models were built for an era of 0% interest rates and an era of large-scale asset purchases and an era of slowflation. And we're seeing, you know, the emperor has no clothes pretty clearly here. And, you know, as it relates to, you know, two flat yield curves, as it relates to higher cost of capital, wider credit spreads for banks, and all that means negative carry. So, you know, NIM compression, you know, it's a future state of enhanced regulation and forced capital raises. And all of that is against this, you know, huge headwind that's really the catalyst here, which is this continued deposit flight story. Too low deposit rates versus customers who are then being incentivized to continue shifting money out and into money market funds that sit at the RRP or direct into bills that are offering magnitudes higher premium. So it's that two-tiered U.S. banking system, you know, that Janet Yellen got absolutely pinched on in her testimony 2 weeks ago in that clip that went viral. And basically it's telling you that there's like a structural long-term placeholder trade here that's like long G-SIBs or long the SIFI banks versus short regional banks. And the implications of it from the big picture is that, you know, this profitability and solvency crisis becomes a massive financial conditions tightener. And ultimately, you know, in a fractional reserves banking system where, you know, this is the transmission mechanism for U.S. economic growth, the global economy is going to get toasted because these banks are going to go into zombie mode at best. And at worst, it means that, you know, credit and lending doesn't flow out into the economy. So it's a really big story. It's a really significant story. And it's where this cycle that's kind of been on this, you know, slow autopilot for the last while as, you know, Fed hiked rates and without a lot of market impact. Now it's really taking a turn.
It seems to me that the biggest risk here is what I'm calling the why not too big to fail trade, where a lot of people look at this and say, look, I can't tell whether or not my bank is encumbered or if it's in trouble. Maybe they're hiding the whatever duration risk they're taking a loss on. They're hiding it because they've marked all of those securities as hold to maturity so they don't have to report where their losses are. You know, screw it. I'm going to get out of this and I'm going to go to one of the big four banks because I know the Fed is going to bail them out no matter what happens. If the whole world does that, it results in a complete collapse of the smaller banks, and that wouldn't be good. But, you know, I look at this and I think, why wouldn't a rational actor say, I can't tell what's going on with my regional bank. I'll just take everything to Citibank or, you know, to one of the other really big banks. Is that a risk of the entire, you know, it seems like once that starts, that I guess it's a form of a safety trade, you know, a flight to safety or a flight to too big to fail. Once it gets going, it seems to me that that's self-reinforcing, and I'm not sure what anybody could do to unwind it.
I could not agree more. There is, honest to God, no justification at this point. there is no edge that they provide. Like, think about Civ B, right? I mean, if the thesis was like you have access to this network of, you know, like-minded venture cap seed founders, you know, at preferable terms, and we're the smartest guys in the room. Well, look what that got you, right? It was this massive, absurd concentration risk, not just, you know, from the nature of kind of the demographic of the, you know, the client that they were dealing with, but all of those assets were basically a leverage long bond position, right? All those things are a function of easy money policy era. And they're under tremendous pressure. I mean, that was the thing, right? The deposit outflows happened because, one, their deposits were burning cash because of the nature of their business being, you know, very duration sensitive, very interest rate sensitive. But then, two, you know, obviously they, you know, they created kind of their own run on this thing. But that's the exact picture. Like, there is no edge. There is no rationale to not continue that flight. And again, particularly when you have these massive headwinds against you that we just went over, you know, the higher funding costs, the tougher regulation, forced capital raises, and lower deposits, which just means that, and you know, we could turn this into, you know, are the recent liquidity actions QE or not conversation. You know, it's those types of banks don't work anymore. And I'll say this. The problem is that they are incredibly important from a lending perspective. You know, just like some stats, this is Federal Reserve data. But if you're looking at banks outside of the top 25 US lenders and their share of all outstanding loans in the US, it's absolutely wild. The percentage of all loans overall for small and medium lenders is 38%. 28% of all commercial and industrial loans is small and medium lenders. 37% of all residential real estate. This is the big one, obviously, the market's focused on. 67% of all commercial real estate loans, 27% of credit cards, 15% of auto loans, 48% of other consumer loans. You know, this is at the core of exactly what we're talking about. Like, the Fed tightening that began last year, that began to wreck all of these duration, long duration assets, was that, you know, the emperor has no clothes and the tide goes out dynamic, right? Anything that was really just a function of a decade of keeping rates at zero and a decade of large scale asset purchases and a decade of forward guidance that suppressed volatility, all that stuff was built for an era of no inflation. And it was inconceivable that you could ever see a tightening cycle this short and violent. And here we are. And now we're finding out all these structures, whether it's private equity, which is just, you know, which looks a lot like, frankly, you know, profitless tech, which looks a lot like venture cap, which looks a lot like, you know, we repeat, commercial real estate, right? You know, when you don't have access to perpetual funding at zero, these models don't work. And that's where we are. And that's why, you know, now if you're talking about these banks that have no structural edge and are kind of a terminal short in some ways, if they're touching this much of the lending and the money flow and the credit flow in the United States economy, you know, we just accelerated into a pretty substantial hard landing.
What would it mean to the financial system if we see this flight from regional banks into too big to fail banks just because people are afraid of this exposure? As you say, it's going to knock out a whole bunch of lending. How does that cycle end? Does it end up with the too big to fails getting even bigger by acquiring those regional banks? I mean, that's just making the too big to fail problem worse. But at the same time, it would be hard for regulators to stand in the way of an acquisition that's designed to essentially catch a failing bank before it fails. You know, what would we do in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of market desire for some quick headlines with regards to, you know, private investors stepping up, you know, everybody tracking private jet flights into Omaha that first weekend, you know, things like that. You know, obviously, there still are a fair bit of questions with regards to the quality of the assets and those loan books of many of these banks. You know, I do think that, you know, one thing that we saw that was pretty underwhelming from a market response perspective is when you got those initial headlines, let's say with FRC that, you know, a consortium of banks were going to step up and, you know, kind of backstop whatever. Well, all they were doing was taking deposits that had inflowed to those larger SIFI banks and basically just redirecting them back. The story here and the bigger issue here, and this is why, you know, I referenced earlier that none of these vehicles, none of these liquidity vehicles are a sort of a form of backdoor QE, is that none of this stuff is going back into the real economy, right? You know, people are saying, like, look at the balance sheet growing over the past 2 weeks from the usage of these, you know, lending facilities. Well, first of all, they're interbank lending facilities, right? Which just tells you the stuff is, you know, in this type of cycle and where we are is kind of stuck interbank, but it's not QE, right? The Fed balance sheet is growing because banks are borrowing funds via pledging collateral back to these facilities. And again, as I said, it's extremely unlikely in this phase of the economic cycle that this, you know, quote, money ends up anywhere but replacing the lost deposits, right? And in that case, it'll end up back at the RRP or in a money market fund or in bills, right? It's not being lent back out or transmitted into the real economy through credit creation. People aren't taking on risk. They're tightening lending standards as they have to shrink their balance sheet, right, in this type of environment. So there's no impulsive net liquidity injection. There's no meaningful stimulative impact. You know, the big banks, they don't want these assets sitting on their books. You know, there's obvious political dynamics at play now. We just actually, during the Fed meeting, as we were watching this before, you know, we recorded, you know, there was a headline snuck in there, you know, actually from Janet Yellen, which, you know, I think really caught the market flat-footed on top of some of the Powell commentary that was, you know, relatively dismissive of the bank's issue for now. And Janet Yellen said, we're not considering broad increase in deposit insurance. That's because it would require an act of Congress to do that. And due to the bipartisanship that is currently running at full tilt, as you know, most folks are aware, that's dead on arrival. It's not going to happen. So at some point, if you do see the big folks have to step up and buy some of these assets, they're going to have a lot of leverage, because at that point, you don't have, even if there is political pushback and, you know, from the Elizabeth Warrens of the world, the fact is you don't have a lot of other options at that point. So it's just, all of this is negative for sentiment. It's negative for any of this money or liquidity to get back into, move back into kind of growth positive, economically constructive, you know, lending and credit creation. It almost reminds me to a certain extent of what we used to say kind of about, you know, China in that, after that post massive growth era in the early 2000s. Like, at some point you're pushing on a string. And in this type of economic environment where it's this most anticipated recession ever, and we've been all been waiting and waiting and waiting, and the economy just stays so, you know, so coiled, labor stays so coiled, services inflation, you know, staying so robust, you know, wages, you know, sticky near highs, there are all these positives, there's all these, you know, supportive catalysts out there, but at the same time, sentiment is so fickle. And when a lot of these, you know, loans and a lot of this lending has been concentrated into these key growth drivers for the past 10 years that really look a lot like, you know, kind of a long bonds position. Again, we keep focusing on commercial real estate, but like, look what office REITs have been doing. They've been making, you know, kind of pre-crisis lows. I'm talking great financial crisis lows during this whole period, because it's, you know, this is going to be a massive dead weight on bank balance sheets. And that is a lot to overcome in light of this still relatively buoyant economy. Once you start losing jobs, once corporate margins start getting hit and they start laying people off, the whole story, you know, really unravels. Then the consumer cracks, and then, you know, there's just a massive, you know, disinflationary impulse, which is why the market is, you know, keeps conflicting with kind of the Fed dots message. You know, when you're looking at STIRS futures curves, that they're telling a very different story, because once you do eventually have to cut here, you're going to have to cut large and cut pretty fast.
Let's move on to the monetary policy implications of this banking crisis, or formative banking crisis. Seems to me we've finally reached the point where the Fed is damned if they do, damned if they don't. If they were to really try to fight inflation as much as they want to, they would probably be hiking rates more than the 25 basis points we got on Wednesday afternoon. But if they went more, they would probably exacerbate the banking crisis. So it seems like they can't do any of the policy objectives that they want to do because they're stuck in this damned if you do, damned if you don't. Is that going to get worse? And if so, are we at the beginning of a process where the Fed loses control over the markets, or is it not that bad?
Well, the damned if you do, damned if you don't observation is bang on. I mean, that's clearly where there's going to have to be a trade-off. And I think the market does feel that simply just buying time as, you know, the economy slows and you do begin to tilt closer to that earnings recession environment, you know, that there are some positives there that, that would allow the Fed to take the foot off the gas of the tightening. And that's why, you know, really at this point, the Fed just, tipped their hat to say, you know, we probably got one more hike at best and then we're done. The trick is that the market, you know, wants cuts and wants cuts fast. And what's it going to take to get cuts? You're going to have to see either, you know, labor turn and crater fast, right? You know, a quick string of some negative non-farm payrolls that confirm that all of that lagged and variable tightening from last year has caught up to us. The problem is that's going to happen then at the same time as a function of, you know, margins really being crunched and, you know, from corporate America. And that's when you get the earnings recession. So it doesn't feel very good. Obviously, the Fed will tell you they're not super concerned about equities per se. The thing that we have to watch is credit. And, you know, when you start seeing this type of environment where, you know, bank spreads are widening now because of all of the dynamics that we spoke about with regards to these structural impediments to profitability, as well as idiosyncratics like, you know, this very foggy interpretation of, you know, AT1 cocoa bonds with the Credit Suisse stuff. But it all leads into a dynamic where the cost of money, the cost of funding is going higher. And that clogs up the mechanism that, that really drives this economy. And, only when that happens, you kind of have to sit here and wait for bad stuff to happen before you can take action in this environment. Because as it currently stands, you know, there is still this inflation backdrop and there still is this, you know, very robust full employment backdrop that is almost too strong for the Fed. So you're sitting here waiting for bad things to happen. And, you know, that's why I like to say, you know, markets, we've just been running to stand still for a while. It's a race against time. The Fed is buying time right now at this point and hoping that inflation solves for itself in the next kind of 3 months. At that point, if we start losing jobs, then it's a lot easier for the Fed to begin needing to cut. But the one point I'll make about cuts is that the way that this cycle went, you know, jumping from 25s into 50s into 75s, we're still very, you know, there still is a lot of thought that if we hit the fan or, you know, hiking that much, there needs to be commensurate cuts on the way coming out because it was such a violent cycle. And I think that's going to be, you know, that's going to be the real challenge here is that, you know, they're not going to be cutting 25 bips if we run into the brick wall and start seeing, you know, negative non-farm payrolls.
It seems to me that the material change here is that the Fed is no longer able to fight inflation as hard as they might have liked to previously. In other words, before, if they thought they needed to fight inflation hard, they'd just raise more. Now they've figured out if they raise more, they're going to break something else. So how do we translate that to a trade opportunity? Is it long gold because they can't raise rates to fight inflation, so gold's going to benefit, or is it something else? What do we do to make money on this?
Well, you've definitely been seeing, you know, once the bank stuff really accelerated in the past, you know, in the past 2 weeks, people started looking for stuff that has beta to, you know, a dovish tilt, has beta to lower, you know, treasury yields. And, you know, one of the clearest expressions was gold. And one of the clearest expressions was, to a certain extent, you know, Bitcoin. We saw, you know, upside buyers in these things, upside optionality buyers in these things, just under the belief that you kind of win in either direction. you know, but particularly if the Fed has to, you know, slam the brakes on their tightening and start to ease, there's that kind of speculative dynamic there, more so on the Bitcoin side, that really benefits. At the same time, gold gives you a little bit more risk off, flight to quality, flight to safety type of a trade. I think the bigger story of the past 2 weeks really has just been a super clear kind of cross asset recession escalation. You know, you had this blast of US Treasury curve bull steepening. That's always, we talked about that, man, 5 years ago, I think, on some old podcast, right? That's always the true recession signal. It's the steepening. You know, as front end, as those massive shorts in the front end and STIRS market got stopped out, you know, as we went from hikes turning into sooner cuts, crude oil got wrecked. You know, crude oil was kind of down 15% month to date, something like that. And then equities thematically, it was clear as day too, just a massive downshift, you know, whereas a lot of the year to date rally kind of prior to March had been in all of those very crowded shorts from last year. There was the unprofitable tech stuff that was, you know, getting wrecked appropriately because of the hiking cycle. Well, that was everybody's alpha last year. So there were crowded shorts. Everybody had to start unwinding those shorts as we, you know, ripped in January out of the gates. And there was that belief that we were approaching disinflation. Well, now, you know, in the last 2 weeks, there's just been a walloping impulse that is very much kind of like a safety kind of slowdown type of a trade where cyclical value, right? The stuff that's geared to a hot economy or leverage factor, which are kind of, you know, high default probability types of companies, you know, leverage balance sheets, that stuff's down kind of 8 to 10% month to date as market neutral strategies. But what is working is low risk factor, right? You know, kind of classic, like long defensive, short high beta. And then, you know, just sector wise, it's been this kind of duration barbell, I like to say. It's almost like the, you know, it looks a lot like the QE era of the 20 teens, right? Where from the easy money period there, where, you know, you hide in the liquidity and high cash flow of mega cap tech as your high beta, but then you pair it with defensives and bond proxies as your low beta duration exposure. And that's all against a short or an underweight in those very growth sensitive cyclicals as the economic cycle turns the page now into this higher probability of a hard landing. And that's, you know, on a month to date basis, that's almost exactly what we're looking at from like S&P sector performance, where the top five sectors are comm services, infotech, staples, utes, and healthcare. I mean, that's pure secular growth as your, you know, the one side of your barbell, and pure defensives as the other side. And the, you know, the bottom five of the, you know, bottom six sectors are all cyclicals. You know, it's industrials and energy and materials and financials and all that good stuff that's, you know, going to run into a wall as we hit the hard landing. So the market has already identified those trades. And it's this kind of flight to quality, up in quality type of a trade and out of stuff that needs, that has, you know, financing needs. Like I said, the leverage balance sheet and all those things that are really going to hit a tough patch here when with the stuff that the Fed cares about, which is, you know, do the credit markets remain open? Does high yield issuance come to a dead stop? That's typically the pain point for them, whether it's on spread or if that's actually like an issuance dynamic where we start seeing a week straight of no high yield bond deals getting done, things like that. That's really what they care about, because that tells you that, you know, the economy is going to stop working.
Charlie, I'm glad you brought up that podcast we did a few years ago talking about how to trade going into a recession cycle and the steepener and so forth. I just want to let our listeners know that is probably just as relevant today as the day it was recorded several years ago. Just put Charlie's name in the search box at macrovoices.com. Look for an interview titled Charlie McElligott, Fear the Steepener. It was a great interview. I remember it well. Charlie, let's move on, or actually come back to the banking crisis. Before the bank situation blew up, there had been a turn up in the VIX, which is the broader stock market volatility index, but it's not at all specific to banking. You guys look at a lot of these internals and you know how these things really work. Was the VIX smelling out what was coming in the banking crisis, or was that unrelated?
Well, there's a chicken or the egg dynamic here, right? So I think that a lot of folks saw that the way VIX acted last year, and this has been a talking point for effectively a full year now, you know, where it was this crashless sell-off. I think we discussed that maybe the last time we spoke, this idea that in that post everything duration era, where anything that worked for over 10 years looked like a long bond, you know, it's secular growth tech, FANG, unprofitable tech, venture cap, private equity, commercial real estate, all that stuff, that, you know, when you finally had this inflation overshoot and this violent tightening cycle, that stuff was going to go wrong way. Well, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, the fact of the matter was, it was this, you know, I say neon swan. We knew that that was the scenario it was going to take. So you just had this grinding deleveraging out of exposure last year, out of all those legacy trades. And what that meant, why there's so many questions, like, you know, there's, you know, look at the market every day, you know, it just grinds lower. It doesn't gap down. It doesn't crash. But what's the deal? That was the problem, right? You didn't have exposure on, so you didn't need to grab into kind of new downside protection, into new crash. Your net exposures were, you know, single digit historicals on 5 or 10 year basis, right? So like barely any length on, if not short, and you had all time high cash. So you didn't really need a downside hedge. That's why skew, right, that relative kind of measure of demand for a put versus a call, was like zero percentile for large parts of last year. Put skew, more, you know, which is a kind of a measure of really kind of wingy downside versus, you know, something that's closer to at the money, was also zero percentile, just because there, you didn't have the exposure on, you didn't need to hedge anything. Then why pay away even more performance? If anything, cash was your hedge, right? Cash is an at the money put. The only demand for crash was for crash up, because you didn't have exposure on, you were scared to death of missing a rally, missing a dovish Fed meeting, missing that big first CPI miss, missing that big first NFP, right? You didn't really get those, but we saw that in the back part of last year. You know, I think November and October, the average S&P up day was 2x that of the average S&P down day, right? We saw various times spot up, vol up, right? As the market went up, vol went up, because people were kind of grabbing into upside. Well, we turned into this year and people started adding back exposure in January. So you saw skew begin to turn. You saw actually need for hedges again. But the real big thing that mattered, and this is that idea of the chicken or the egg, is that, you know, we knew, the market sensed, the market got the joke that, you know, the lagging variable tightening, there was going to be a come to Jesus moment. And we saw signs of opaque parts of credit starting to get squirrely. You know, you saw financial conditions, you know, get pretty tight, and you started seeing these problems, you know, begin to appear, i.e. like what's happened with banks the last few weeks. And there has been, for the last kind of 2 months, some really kind of pervasive, consistent upside buying in VIX. And the thing that was important about that upside buying is that, you know, VIX isn't the same kind of market that it was a few years ago, prior to March of 2020, prior to Volmageddon and, you know, February of 2018. It's skinny. And to a certain extent, it can be cornered. And it was the first real kind of short convexity or negative convexity or negative gamma problem that you've seen in VIX for a few years from a dealer positioning perspective. And that can tend to self-fulfill. In this case, knowing that we were closer to an accident, as accidents were increasingly occurring, you know, it put us closer to some of these dynamics realizing, and that short convexity catching dealers in a spot where kind of the higher vol went, you know, the more they needed to buy to stay hedged. And we finally got that over the past 2 weeks, where you finally got this big vol outperformance versus spot after the prior year, where we basically hit, you know, one percentile, I think, looking back 20 years on vol underperformance versus spot. So you're actually in a more normalized state of kind of the traditional VIX relationship. And that, frankly, has been healthy and much needed. You know, for what it's worth, as of the day of recording this, there was a lot of that VIX upside that expired. And that was part of the big rally that we saw on, you know, Tuesday, the 21st going in, as a lot of these were sliding away from those call strikes. And that actually forced dealers to sell Vega and buy Delta. That was part of the rally up into this. And then you got this kind of lackluster, not quite dovish Fed. Plus, you got the Janet Yellen comments with regards to deposit guarantees. And here we are. People started buying that upside again, you know, further out in the months ahead. So VIX is going to stay tense. And that means, you know, bigger market moves, which, you know, I'm here for.
Speaking of volatility, let's move on to the subject that was the subject of a lot of conversation before the banking crisis took over the headlines, which was zero-day to expiration options. Now, Charlie, as you know, there's been, you know, since there's been options, every option has a last day of trading where it has, you know, only one day left. But we've actually suddenly reached a point. I mean, it used to be nobody traded them on the last day. You know, it was like nobody goes and tries to cash in their life insurance, you know, one day before it would expire otherwise. But all of a sudden, they're being traded so actively that exchanges are actually listing more option contracts in order to make sure there will be more zero-day to expiration options every single day of the week. There's some option that's expiring today that you can trade. And this is not, you know, crazy Wall Street silver guys gone wild. This is institutional risk managers that are using one-day options to hedge real institutional risk. What's going on here? Why are people doing this in the first place? And what effect is it having on market volatility?
You know, I think the first blush was that as we finally, mid last year, you know, tilted towards actually having an expiration every day for the first time. And these products were kind of created from the exchange. There was this initial feel that, okay, you know, these are lottery tickets, and it's kind of it's very similar to what we saw with the meme stock, you know, Wall Street Bets stuff back in 2021, where they were means of creating gamma squeezes. They were, again, you know, cheap ways to play for big outcomes, big moves, and you could help kind of bully the market in either direction. You know, what was interesting about our analysis is these have grown into clearly now not a retail tool, even though, yes, very popular with retail. I mean, one out of every two, you know, SPY options on a daily basis is now a zero DTE option. But it's also a big S&P contract dynamic. You know, it's like 49% is kind of like the high day. And this is generally speaking, it's like basically one out of two there also. There's a couple of different ways we look at this. One of the things that our work has done was to identify this idea that, you know, what is the usage of these things, right? It, just talking about volume, just talking about increased open interest doesn't tell you anything. You need to know if these are, you know, calls bought or calls sold or, you know, puts bought or puts sold. And what we did then was that when you talk about the exchange itself, the SIBO tags the kind of four end user types. There's like broker dealer, there's broker dealer prop, which is somewhat antiquated, I think, from a different era of obviously prop. There is customer, and then there's market maker. So you can separate out the kind of net end users. In the case of what we were trying to do, which is identify how are people using this, we want to isolate customers. On the other side, what was very clear was that it was market makers. And I differentiate market makers from broker dealers is because by and large, this is a pure product of electronic options market makers. And, you know, I think, you know, folks at home can kind of determine that that is not really a bank's thing. That's the electronic market makers. You know, a lot of these big, you know, securities firms that used to be into the high frequency trading game, frankly. And those folks are basically on a kind of a day by day basis, they're basically, you know, selling gamma, right? They're selling, they're either short a straddle or short a strangle when we look at the moneyness buckets of all the options that trade on a day. But if you look at kind of in that, generally speaking, you know, out of the money upside, so like 101% to 103% calls, or you look in the out of the money, you know, put stuff like 97 to 99% puts, customers are net buyers. What we do is we run an imbalance. We look at the time and sales to create kind of a buy pressure analysis. If something trades below the midpoint, it was somebody hitting a bid, right? It was a seller. If it trades above, it was somebody lifting an offer. And what we see almost on an everyday basis, there have been a handful of days where it hasn't been this definitive, but generally speaking, customers are buying these options. And that's customers. That's, you know, that's generally speaking, you know, this kind of like institutional plus, you know, smaller amount of retail. And they're trying to create gamma squeezes. Also, though, at the same time, look at the nature of all risk in the past year. It's been one day phenomenon. It's been, you know, this week's CPI, this month's CPI print, this month's NFP, this month's FOMC, this month's Humphrey Hawkins or Jackson Hole or ECB meeting, et cetera. You want hedge products that are going to be very sensitive to, you know, just as sensitive as kind of the risk that you're trying to protect. And honestly, one of the big lessons of last year was, you know, longer dated options didn't pay. They didn't protect. They didn't, you know, tail hedge. You know, that was puts, and that was, you know, that was long puts, that was long gamma. They just didn't work. So you want something that's, you know, really convex and can do the job for that day of risk. So these things are used to hedge as well. I would say that even though it's this very clear delineation of market makers or sellers, we're, by the way, running short a straddle or short a strangle on a daily basis, you know, is a great sharp ratio. Like there's a reason they want to do this and they're taking their pound of flesh, you know, on the trade. The vast majority of these things are going to expire worthless. But the fact of the matter is, generally speaking, customers are buyers of these things and they try to push the market around. There are days without a doubt where I'm, you know, quite convinced that, you know, some funds are going to be willing to sell out of the money tails on a down move, sell an out of the money put on a down move, because there's a regulatory arbitrage in these things where they're gone by the end of the day, right? So you don't need to post collateral with your prime broker. They're not on your book, right? So you can kind of do that and generate a credit to go buy an out of the money call. And that way you get some like free convexity. You know, those are attractive trades for people. But by and large, it's very clear cut. And the reason I'm bringing all this up is that, you know, regulators are calling and asking, like, what's the deal with these things? Well, I'm actually very comfortable with this kind of framework because, one, they mean revert, right? You buy, you create this gamma squeeze, but guess what? You have to monetize that if it comes in your favor, right? So you're kind of taking it off. And that's a little bit of what we saw. You actually saw higher intraday movement as the gamma was hedged, but on a close-to-close vol basis, you actually compress volatility. Because you're not kind of exploding out of a range most days. So I want the risk held by, I want the people who are short the gamma, I want the risk held by the practitioners that have risk management, that have large balance sheets. I don't want to see customers randomly without thinking shorting tails for yield. That's the pennies in front of a steamroller trade where I can't trust how they're going to respond when you do get that big headline or you do get that big shock print that, you know, creates a real inconsistency. So I'm okay with this current market structure and the way they're currently being used. It does not mean that it's always going to be, you know, it's always going to be, you know, this kind of tidy. But right now it actually is where it's an accelerant flow intraday. But, you know, because these are very convex instruments with a lifespan of 6.5 hours max. But by the end of the day, generally speaking, these things are either going to they're going to mean revert because you got to monetize them and take them off, or they're going to expire worthless.
Charlie, the group that you lead at Nomura is semi-famous for the work that you do on modeling what trend-following CTAs are going to do next, essentially. Your daily note actually gives institutional traders a list of levels, basically saying, you know, if the S&P gets here, that's where the CTAs are going to start buying or selling and so forth. And that's been very popular with institutional traders. It seems to me like, I don't know what's going on, but it feels to me like the gods of markets have stopped being nice to trend followers. It seems like these guys just keep getting whipsawed out of their trend trades. Is there some underlying technical reason? Is this something to do with dealer gamma? What is driving this, and why is it that all of a sudden the CTA, and it's usually a very reliable strategy, seems like they're getting nailed lately?
It's a great thought. Look, the last year was a generational tail environment. CTA trend is a phenomenal tail hedge. The back test proves it. It's because it can be kind of short the kind of traditional bond stock, bonds is your hedge correlation. You know, that's what happened last year. That's why 60-40 got crunched. That's why risk parity type of, you know, exposures got crunched. In this case, the ability to be short assets and long dollar, right, long cash, was the only trade that worked last year, and it worked all year. It was the most definitively clear trend trade that I've probably, you know, seen in my career. And what that did, that meant, you know, this remarkable environment for CTAs where they finished the year kind of up somewhere in the mid 30% range, right? And the thing was too, is as fundamental investors were kind of stopped out of the market last year, it further empowered and activated and amplified the flows of CTA trend into, you know, the feedback loop, which was just kind of like long dollar, short assets. Well, the problem was, you know, the cycle began to turn. The end of tightening was pulled forward as we thought that there was going to be this disinflationary trade and to start the year. And because the Fed said so, right? I mean, Jerome Powell and his, you know, 21 mentions of disinflation, I think, in January Fed, you know, and you started seeing the data soften a little bit. And all of a sudden, everybody was really into this short dollar, anti-dollar, long rest of world trade. It worked magnificently. And January, you know, part of that was kind of China reopen. Obviously, part of that was Europe not going into a hard landing because the energy crisis and the kind of quote 100 delta certainty of a hard landing there didn't materialize because of, you know, the Ukraine Russia war stayed contained. People got their gas stockpiles up and you had a really mild winter. Well, then Europe was much less bad than feared. Europe is leveraged to China economy through luxury and things like that. So there was this symbiotic feedback loop into all of these kind of reversals of last year's trends. And that's brutal for CTA, right? They want clear runway. And, you know, every other month this year, and you know, in the case of some every other week, you've had this incredible chop, this incredible theme chop. Obviously, what happened in January got reversed in February because of that less bad than feared dynamic, saw growth surprise to the upside. And it reinstituted, got everybody worried about, you know, higher terminal rates and the Fed accelerating hiking when part of the assumption coming into the year that was so wrong was that H1, the first half of the year, you're going to get this imminent recession. In H2, you're going to get the slowdown and the Fed was going to begin easing. Part of that was then this view that you were going to get one or two more hikes, pause and cut. Well, my big note in January was like the worst, you know, the biggest mispricing in the market was saying, well, what if that's not the case? What if prematurely easing from the Fed meant that financial conditions loosened and the economy was able to reaccelerate? And that's exactly what happened in January as per the, you know, the January data release in February. We got that huge rates move, that huge FCI tightening. We added at one point like 100 bips of to terminal rate. And guess what that meant? That meant that financial conditions tightened all of a sudden and you reversed the trend again. And, you know, it was this potential headwind for data, but then you add on the legacy lagged and variable impacts of last year's tightening. You started having these accidents. Well, that's been the story of March. You reverse the other direction, big FCI easing, you know, in light of the banks and people now ending the tightening cycle and pricing in cuts. And here we are, CTAs have been absolutely chopped up and you saw it, you know, in these double-digit standard deviation shock moves in these legacy front-end shorts that both for macro pods and you know, trend followers were by far the largest driver of alpha, hence the largest trade on their books for the past year period. And, you know, you just went from this, you know, banking crisis escalation, VAR shock and crowded rate shorts, and then a full reset of global central bank monetary policy paths from what was just a few weeks ago, Jerome Powell buying back his 50 bips hike option to now suddenly implied cuts. So they just got ripped. And what it did was that anything trend momentum in any strategy running short gamma just got torched. You just had two-way overshoot price action. And I mean, think about the Fed today is the you know, volatility, lower volatility likes compressed distribution of outcomes. Think about into the Fed today. There was delta on a hike, a pause, and even a cut. So, you know, all of that very kind of wide path that developed into today was a big part of that rate vol explosion, was a big part too of this big stop out in the most crowded, most profitable trade of the past year. And it's been a disaster for, you know, CTAs and systematic trend followers, as well as macro funds these past 2 weeks, just some acute losses. And you've seen it. You've seen it with liquidity, and you've seen it with the market trading wildly overshooting in both directions.
Charlie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview today. But before I let you go, I want to talk about the daily letter that you publish for institutional investors. First, I'm just going to break the bad news to our retail audience. Unfortunately, Charlie's hands are tied. Don't hate Charlie. He's a good guy. His compliance department is not nearly as nice as he is, and they don't let him do what he wants to do. So unfortunately, if you're a retail trader, you cannot get Charlie's letter. But for our institutional audience, people who do have work for an organization that has an institutional relationship with Nomura, your letter is just incredibly popular. A lot of people are really excited about it. So please tell us both what listeners need to do in order to get your letter if they already have an institutional relationship with Nomura, which they would need in order to get it, and what they can expect to find in it when they subscribe.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it, my friend. Look, it's, you know, we're in the content game, and you know, resourcing and payment for content is you know the ugly truth here. You know, it is thought to be pretty valuable in the fact that it has a top down view, but it is tactical. It does hit on some of the more opaque parts of the market with it, you know, positioning and systematic flows and crowded narratives and how things kind of go wrong being my overall framework, you know, looking for, you know, asymmetries. And I do think it provides a valuable kind of blind spot filler for a lot of folks. Look, if you are an institutional client of the firm, obviously you make contact with your salesperson. There is a revenue threshold to make sure that the content is not diluted. We can't give it away for free, but you know, that's why you're a client, and we appreciate the opportunity to add value.
Well, for people who are qualified, I very highly recommend it. You've got some terrific content there, and it is every single day. It's one of the most interesting reads that comes across my desk. So, Charlie, I look forward to seeing you again soon. We'll get you back for another update in a few months. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Charlie back on the show. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to those charts. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Charlie's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now let's jump into it. On page 2, Eric, I wanted to just start with this crude oil. What are you thinking here, and how'd those EIA inventory numbers come in?
EIA inventory came in with a build on crude oil inventories of 1.1 million barrels, but that was the only build on the board. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.1 million barrels. Gasoline was the big draw on the board, 6.4 million barrels. Distillates, 3.3 million barrel drawdown. U.S. production, 12.2 million barrels, unchanged. Really been holding that 12.2, 12.3 million barrel level for quite a few months now. So it feels like U.S. production has reached a plateau, and the pattern of growth in U.S. production seems to have ended, at least for now. This week brought us a test of 64 spot 59, which was the 55-month moving average, just about exactly. Only traded for just a few minutes and a few cents below that level, briefly. Now we're $6 higher. Does that mean the bottom is finally in on this market? I'm not sure yet. The recession and bank crisis fears seem to be hitting the tape pretty darn hard. But, you know, if you stop and think about it, if we have a banking crisis, that is going to affect funding, and it's going to affect the supply side of oil, probably even worse than it's going to affect the demand side. So the fear that there's a bank crisis that is potentially going to put the banking system at risk, is that really bearish, or is it actually bullish in disguise? We had Pierre Anderonde, a very well-known crude oil trader and fund manager, saying that he expects $140 crude before this year is out. That would be double today's prices. So we'll see what happens here. But to my eye, it's just about make or break time for the markets. 70.08 was the previous low before we broke down considerably lower last week. Are we going to get back above that level and hold it? If so, maybe the bottom is in and a recovery is beginning. As I'm speaking, it was 70.12 right now. It was below 70.08 as I started with that paragraph, and we're now back above it. So we're right teetering on that level early Thursday morning before the U.S. Open. As far as what happens next, let's wait and see. I think the sentiment is definitely that if this bank crisis gets worse, it's probably going to hit oil worse to the downside. I think that may be a real buying opportunity in disguise. The number I'm looking at, if the market really bails and capitulates here to the downside, would be 58.93. That's the 100-month moving average. That also would be the $22 measured move, which would be the same as the big move that we had down the last time back on, I think it was November 7th, that WTI had a brief breakout above its 100-day moving average, 100-day continuation chart moving average. Fake breakout failed, was $22 down. Last time we had the same thing, a fake breakout above the 100-day, only lasted for one day and then promptly failed. If we went another $22 down from there, it would be $58 right around that 100-month moving average. So that would be my downside target if this fails again here. But I think it's going to be a question of what happens in terms of perceptions about whether the banking crisis is over or not. And if it turns out that fear of banking crisis takes us down lower, I think that's going to be a buying opportunity, because I think the banking crisis result is going to affect supply more than it's going to affect demand.
Yeah, Eric, in my mind, this breakdown in crude oil was a significant technical washout. When all of the major support line along that 72 to 74 level occurred, it obviously spurred all the technicals down, caused a wave of traders to be stopped out. Now we're getting that reaction off of a new support line, which is establishing around $65. To me, there's this old adage of what were previous lows now act as overhead resistance. And while oil was incredibly oversold and due for a bounce, the real information happens when crude oil here trades into the 72-74 level, whether or not it rejects there, because a rejection means that the prevailing downtrend is not over. Another impulse down could happen that could even go as low as $60 on a next impulse down. Now, for the bulls, they basically just need to clear this level. If we see any meaningful rally that completely wipes out the March sell cycle and we're back into that trade range zone in the mid-70s where all those high volume node zones that were occurring, that would neutralize the sell cycle and be the first chance the bulls have had to really technically reverse this downtrend. Nonetheless, right now, we're going to get the real tell right along that level. But let's move on to the equity markets. I know all of us want to talk about it, but Nick, let's start with you. What levels are you watching on the SPX?
The S&P had a crazy move yesterday after the FOMC, Patrick. And again, the support and resistance levels haven't really changed at all. The 4,000 area remains a key area for both the bulls and the bears. Right now, it's acting as resistance. Yesterday, we popped over it temporarily and then pulled back down. Everything that Powell discussed was pretty bearish overall. I wouldn't say anything was bullish. So I'm leaning bear side short term. But either way, the support area is at 38.50. Heaviest open interest for tomorrow's OPEX for the call side is at 4,000. On the put side, it's 3,900. And the expected move for tomorrow's OPEX is plus minus 60 points. So spot right now is 39.50. Upside would be just above that key resistance area of 4,000 at 40.10. And downside would be to around 38.90 or so. So I'm thinking that the market is more vulnerable to the downside here, looking at potentially the 3,800 area. If we break below that, it's possible we see the lows from October at 3,600 or so. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
Well, this is playing out pretty much as I expected, as we've discussed for the last couple of podcasts. We survived the 20 basis point hike that a lot of people thought was not going to happen, hiking into a banking crisis with a red candle, needless to say, on Wednesday. But, you know, it only took us down to where we were a day earlier. It did not get us back below the 200-day moving average. And we're bouncing nicely here on Thursday morning early into the European trading session before U.S. markets open. Let's see what Thursday and the rest of the week brings, but I think we may be beginning a new rally back up toward 4,300. That doesn't make any sense to me because I think the Fed is losing control of the markets. I think we've gotten to the point where inflation has run away to the extent that they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, just as I discussed with Charlie McElligott in this week's feature interview. But that's not the perception on the street. The short-sighted view is, hey, the hiking cycle is probably over now. Cuts will probably start sooner than previously expected. And the new normal good news is bad news world that we live in, that's bullish. I don't think it's really bullish, but it might get us back up to 4,300, 4,309, which is the target that I have for as far as I think the bear market rally could take us. And I think eventually in the second half of the year, we're going much lower. But it doesn't look to me like it's set to happen yet.
You know what, guys, I hear both of you in terms of your positioning on this. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is that that 4,000, it continues to be where all the major open interest is on these strikes. And we have that 200-day moving average on page four that I'm showing. We're still above it. But what is interesting to me in all of this is that I still don't see the cracks in the armor in global equity. The Nikkei didn't badly react on this. The Euro stock isn't started some heavy sell cycle. The NASDAQ's holding up along this highs. Yeah, the S&P 500 did turn down, but we haven't yet seen major technical damage. And while I respect both of your opinions and the idea that there is vulnerabilities to the downside here, I just don't see that there's enough evidence to say that a new floodgate of selling has already started. To me, it's very simple. That 200-day moving average conveniently lines up right in the Fib zones around 39.50. And all of those highs from March that were established near that 4,080 level on the upper boundary is a very clear overhead resistance. And I think that the simplest thing to do is simply to see which way the price action ultimately breaks out of that range. And so I'm going to approach this over the next day or two just a little more neutral, really see how things settle in, and then kind of jump onto the coattails and go for the ride. There's still, I think, a small chance that we rally into April, but let's see how this develops. Nonetheless, let's move on. I'm really interested, Nick, in what levels you're thinking here on the Qs.
Yeah, right now the spot on Qs is 309. Expected move for tomorrow's OPEX is plus minus 6 points. So upside 315, which is the high from yesterday, down to the low of 303, that would be the target downside. Right now, we have resistance upside at 312 or so. We broke above it temporarily yesterday and came right back down. On the downside, our support area is around 300. And again, tech has been more resilient than the rest of the market. So interesting to watch here. But you know, I mentioned previously on SPX that I'm bearish there. And I'm also bearish on tech here as well, because a lot of these key names like Google, Apple, Meta are running into resistance areas on the upside.
Interesting you say that, Nick. You know, I was looking on page six. I have the chart of the NASDAQ futures rather than the Qs. And when I just put that 200-day moving average, you can see on this chart that actually without taking the FOMC into consideration and you just look at the price action and the trend, this chart still looks actually structurally bullish. Now, there is a material overhead resistance right along these two highs, very close to this 13,000 level. And this is really going to be the interesting puzzle piece to solve as to whether the bulls have you know, the gas in the tank to punch this to a fresh new year high north of 13,000. If we see that, then it just means that a more bearish move in the market is probably going to push into a sell in May and go away window a month or two from now, and there could still be one leg higher. And at the same time, just looking at this chart, it would take a substantial move of over even 1,000 points to even just start doing technical damage to this prevailing trend. There's a lot of work to do for the Bears if they want to most immediately turn this. And so I'm going to really be watching closely how this shapes up here, especially the first reaction was clear to the FOMC. Now the real tell is going to be how the price action settles in here through Thursday and Friday. All right, Nick, though, I wanted to just touch on page 7 on the VIX. You know, the clearly volatility premiums jumped massively when we were dealing with the first wave of the banking crisis. But in this post-FOMC, there isn't even an uptick on the VIX. What is your take on all of this?
Yeah, right now the VIX is down about 5% today on Thursday as I speak, and sitting around 21 right now. So expect to move in the broad markets about 1.25% or so on a daily basis. But again, I've said in the past that support area of 20 is a key area. If we break below it, we could putter around to that 18 mark, in which case, your thesis will probably transpire and we'll get some upside in the broad markets. Alternatively, if we push back down again in broad markets and the VIX breaks above 25 quickly, which should be probably my case if we see it break below 3,900 or so on SPX, we could see a push perhaps up to as high as 30 again, but we probably need some kind of catalyst, which probably be the next earnings season perhaps. Keep in mind also we have PPI data tomorrow, so that could also be a catalyst in the morning as well, pre-market. But key levels to watch are the 20 area for support, 25 for resistance. And again, if we get over 25, chances are we push up to 30 or so. Now, moving on to page 8, we have the US dollar index over here. I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, guys.
Well, obviously, we're trending down on the dollar index, both during the lead up to this FOMC meeting and in the aftermath, after the hike. Normally a Fed hike would be bullish for the dollar, but a lot of people are convinced that this was the last hike. That certainly is what rate curves are forecasting, is that this was the last hike. The hiking cycle is ended now, and pretty soon they'll start cutting. I am not persuaded of that. It's true that they changed the FOMC statement language to say that, I don't remember exactly what the wording is, but it was essentially changing it from, we think we're going to do more hikes to it may be necessary to do more hikes. They're still leaving the door open to say this is inflation data dependent. If the data says inflation is still a problem, I'm not convinced that they're done hiking. But I think the market is convinced they're done hiking, and that's the reason that we're seeing the lower dollar. The big test, though, would be getting through support at 100 on the Dixie. If we start trading below 100 and stay there for a few days, okay, that says to me that really a bigger move is on to the downside. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if we get down to the bottom of a trading range, the market realizes that maybe hikes are not completely off the table after this meeting. Maybe May 2nd could be another hike if inflation continues to misbehave. And if that expectation comes into the market consciousness, then I certainly think we could see another move back up toward 106 or so. So let's wait and see what happens.
Yeah, Eric, for me, it was really interesting that the US dollar index and traded right down to the 103 level going into the FOMC meeting. And that's not only where the Fib retracement zone is, but it lines up with a 108 level on the euro and a number of other key currency levels on everything from the pound and the US dollar yen. And what clearly was a significant technical break of these kind of levels on the dollar. It was sort of, in my mind, the make it or break it level of where if the dollar was going to have another bull impulse, that's a level that it should have held. And so with this breakdown, it does open that window for a retest of those previous lows in February. And the interesting part is that this is where we have some, cross current, because generally a US dollar that is weakening acts as a tailwind to risk assets. And so here we have a equity market that is starting to get nervous, but a dollar that certainly isn't pushing back on the equity markets holding in here.
Now, if that's the case, guys, what impact does this have on gold?
Well, I added significantly to my longs on the dip down to 1935. I'm glad that I did. Now, so far, the market is just responding to expectations that the market thinks this was the last hike and that cuts are coming. And in terms of real yields, you know, that should be good for gold. I see it as bigger than that. I think that for the last 10 years, we've been living in this post-great financial crisis new normal, where bad news is good news and everything is driven by easy money policy from central banks. We've gotten to the point now where inflation, assuming, of course, if inflation proves to be completely transitory and just goes away, as Mike Green and Alex Gurevich have suggested, then I'm just going to be proven wrong on this one. And, you can't be right about everything. But if I'm right that inflation is here to stay, then we've reached a point where the Fed now is not able to fight inflation the way they need to, because they know that they'll break something else if they continue to do that. So I think we're getting to a point where the Fed is losing its ability to control markets through easy money policy. Once the broader market figures out that that's really what's going on here, I think that's incredibly bullish for gold. But we'll see whether or not I'm right about inflation. If I've got the inflation call wrong, that's going to invalidate everything I just said. If you feel late to the party and you kind of missed out on this huge rally that's already happened in gold, hey, gold mining shares are still badly lagging. So that's where the opportunity is at this point if you are not already in this market. As far as that trade is concerned, the one caveat that I would point out is anytime you get into mining shares, you've got that equity risk that if there's a stock market crash, the mining shares tend to take it hardest. And so if you think we're going to have a stock market crash or a resumption of the bear market in the second half, maybe those mining shares are going to hurt down the road. But for right now, the mining shares are badly underperforming compared to the metal itself. And it seems to me if you're putting new money to work in the gold market, that's where the value is going to be, is in the mining shares.
You know, what's interesting is that outside of the impulse on Bitcoin, it's very hard to find something else in the global macro space that has had as strong of an impulse in the last 2 weeks as gold's breakout. Now, the interesting thing is that we are now trading not only above the February high, but around this huge psychological round number of 2,000. Going back to that March of 2022, when we did break above 2,000, it held only for a day. It was just one big momentum burst that almost immediately reversed. And so we have not seen any significant or meaningful price action north of 2,000. And here we are with the gold bulls having an opportunity to break out that zone. It is going to be so interesting to see whether or not this time around gold has the strength and momentum to break out, because that could cause in itself a substantial headline sentiment shift and could drive flows that could see gold easily make it to 21 or 2200. Nonetheless, this 2000 round number is right here, right now, and I'm going to be watching that really closely to see what happens there next. Now, what I wanted to, though, wrap up the talking chart segment here is looking at government bonds again. In the post-FOMC, I just have the 10-year yield here back down to the bottom of the trade range that has been establishing all year around this 347 basis points. But what is interesting to me is actually on page 11, which is that junk bonds have not bullishly responded to what was a pretty strong impulse higher in Treasury. Now, obviously, Treasury bonds were reacting to the financial crisis, some quantitative easing speculation, and obviously a potential Fed pivot. But what's interesting is up until now, high-yield bonds and junk have more or less been just trading along with interest rates on the broader markets. But without the response here, this is the first time we have seen this year a breakout in high yield credit spreads. We have seen them now trade up to that 5% level. And while that isn't really a panic level, it is the first time since the second quarter of last year where we've seen high yield credit through these spreads start to worsen. And the bigger question is, are the credit spreads starting to sniff out some cracks that could be leading to this recession and or bigger downturn? I don't want to read into just 1 or 2 weeks of price action, but boy, is it an interesting place to suddenly watch, and I'm going to be all eyes on it in the coming days.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, and a number of links to articles that we found really interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.